friends, welcome to Tim's Travails, the monthly podcast by IP attorney and author Timothy Trainer. Today we are interviewing Christopher Chambers, another best-selling author, and just noir is his genre. I love both of these gentlemen. They are clients, Incandescent PR clients, and they both have shows on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. So it is a thrill for me to listen to them talk to each other. The topic today is attorney to attorney, author to author, and I will throw it over to Tim, who will have the interview. Thank you both.
Thank you, Hope. Thank you, Chris, for being here today. It's great. We had a wonderful chat, I thought, a couple weeks ago, and I'm looking forward to this podcast. And I just want to say it's always a little intimidating to talk to somebody who's such a successful writer as you are, with a lot of awards. And
I thought the tree back here is intimidating. You know, look at that.
Well, that too, because I don't have one set up yet here. You've got a great writing career, along with, of course, everything else you do. But today, I think usually I try to focus in on, at least in this episode, the writing part, because that's one of the things we certainly have in common, and you've been doing it for a long time. And you actually, with all the podcasts I've done so far, you're unique in that I think you're the first and only person I've had on that's a lifelong Washington, D.C. person. Everybody else, we've all come from somewhere else. So you have kind of a unique perspective of the city because you're from here. And I'm just curious, how does that influence your writing?
Well, it's you know, the city and the people in it become a character. You know, I'll give you an example. I mean, my fiction mentor, George Pelicanos, who's, you know, a showrunner for HBO, you know, written multiple bestsellers, you know, amazing person. But he was the one who really revolutionized the DC DC fiction book, because up until that point, the DC novel was, you know, a Robert Ludlum hardcover that was 500 pages that had nothing to do with, you know, the neighborhoods,
right.
People. And, you know, you had people like Jim Grady, who wrote 6 Days of the Condor, which became 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford. You know, he was kind of a transitional figure there, but So he introduced noir elements, crime fiction elements into those novels, but he hadn't quite made that transition to, this is about, you know, the regular people, the people, you know, you don't see, the people who ride the Metro bus, the people who, you know, if you're out in the suburbs, you might hear, you know, shooting in some, you know, robbery gone bad, people trying to buy or sell weed or cocaine or something like, I mean, the real deal stuff. And, you know, the real deal stuff is what, you know, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and Chester Himes wrote about, you know, New York or San Francisco, places like that. Well, I mean, George really opened it up because it is a unique place. It is a federal city, but it is a city. It's a city of a lot of plenty and a lot of want.
Right.
And it's on display more so, believe it or not, in a place like New York or San Francisco, because it is the capital.
Yeah.
And it is so weird in terms of, you know, how it's governed and, you know, who lives here and how it grew. So all that becomes a character.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it spills over from nonfiction to fiction. I mean, you know, there's a reason, you know, Donald Trump can do and not do certain things here in the city that he can't do elsewhere.
Right.
It becomes that that kind of unique kind of place.
Yeah. So as well, because you are a lawyer as well, I guess your awareness of what goes on in the city, as well as that legal background, maybe does, how much does that legal background help you in writing the stories you write?
Well, I remember when I was young, somebody said there's either a play a novel or a book of poetries or a script on the C drive. That's how old I am. The C drive of every lawyer in every office in America. So there's that. I mean, you know, people kind of try to go deep cover in terms of their creativity, you know, in order to pay the bills. But at the same time, though, I have to tell you, it's almost like being a journalist. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason why you see a lot of lawyers and a lot of journalists go into this is because we're used to having other eyes on our work product. We don't have that almost extreme Vincent van Gogh craziness about our art that somebody with an MFA might have. Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are MFAs, and they probably are like mad at, you know, me saying that, but they've heard me say that before. Is that, you know, I mean, we're artistic and we're creative, but we don't let that define our personalities because we've had to, you know, do other things for so long and work for other people and show other people our work product that, you know, we're not, that's not to say it doesn't hurt or it doesn't affect us. It's just that it's not the end of the world when somebody says, all right, we'll change that period to a comma, you know, because you know, that's what we do. I mean, and people supervise, as journalists do.
The reason why I'm chuckling here is the first thing I actually tried to write as a novel, which was published, Pendulum Over the Pacific, I handed this massive manuscript over to the first person that I figured I need to have input from, which is another lawyer who happens to be my wife. The editing was done with a nice red pen. This is back in I can't remember, maybe it was late 80s. And after she was done in 200 pages, of this mammoth pile of paper was reduced to almost 40% of it being gone, I had to sit down and rethink how I was going to write, because the other problem I actually had is, you know, really not spending more time trying to be a novelist until I retired. As somebody who's a lawyer and you're writing legal documents, it's a totally different thing. It's a different product. And you have to really mentally work at changing your mindset and approach to actually writing, because it's completely different. And you know, I'm constantly wondering, am I ridding myself of that legal writing thinking so that I can write a novel? And that, for me, that's a massive challenge every day whenever I sit down and write.
Yeah, it for me, it's a little different. I think I understand what you're saying, and I agree. I think the commonality, though, between the legal drafting, you know, with the scrivenering was the old word for it, was that I do have the ability to actually sit down and just start doing it. Hmm. And that is what the legal training has done for me. I need to have the inspiration. Yes, I need to have the research. Yes, I need to have that spark or that muse, you know, appear like a gremlin on my shoulder. But at the same time, the training kicks in where I can just say, all right, it's time to do it. It's time to work. Whereas a lot of people say, well, I got to get up at 4 a.m. and I go from 4 to 6 and I write, or I have this, you know, I try to do 1,000 words or something like that. I'm like, you know, whatever. I sit down and I just do it. And then if I got to get up and go do something else, then I'll go do something else. And that's where the training comes in.
No, I agree with you. I mean, people ask those kinds of questions about, oh, what's your target number of words you're going to write today? I don't have that. I basically, when I do sit down, you know, it may simply be today, I start a scene and I just want to get through that one scene today. Right. And that might be 500 words. It might be 2,500 words, but that's the goal. You know, it's not so much how many minutes a day or hours a day or how many words a day. It's really about, oh, I have this next scene and I need to get through that scene. And it'll be whatever it is, whether time wise or word count wise, it doesn't really matter. That's kind of my approach. And we, you know, everybody has their own approach. It's very different. desperate. So I think what you're telling me actually makes me feel good that, oh, gee, I'm not going about this the wrong way. But then again, who knows what the right way really is? Everybody's
got the right way. Yeah, I don't think there is a right way. And, you know, and again, you know, it also depends on, you know, what the subject matter is. Is it nonfiction? Is it fiction? You know, are you, if it's fiction, are you, as they say, a pantser, which is seat of the pants, or one of these extreme outliners like Jeffrey Deaver, who literally outlines every chapter? Yeah. You know, I mean, and I mean outline like, you know, beyond law school outline, you know, just to that kind of detail.
Yeah.
And people who, I'm kind of a pantser, and I know we did a show with Tracy Clark and Christina Kovacs, who are both pantsers. I mean, and they're basically, they throw a lump of clay down on the ground. They just start looking at it, mm-hmm. and they just move stuff around.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's whatever works.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, obviously there's a little, not a little bit, maybe more than I admit, but once I have the idea at the 100,000 foot level, I start doing the research to say, is this something that I can play with? And then once I've done a certain amount of the research, that's when I start writing it. And then, of course, as I go along, I find out, well, I've got to do a little bit more research. And frankly, I'm constantly doing research to make sure that the storyline's believable. And there are elements there of truth that mixes with the fiction. Because at the end of the day, the last thing I want to read when I read somebody else's book, which is something that's so completely off that all of a sudden it loses a lot of its oomph, if you will, just because of a major error, shall we say, that's just right. Too obvious, you know. But let me ask you a slightly related but different question, which is, you writing about DC, where does that gritty material come from? Do you get out there, or is it just based on historical knowledge, or how do you get that grit that comes into your stories?
Well, it's a combination of historical knowledge and just being, you know, out there. I mean, and frankly, it's such a small city. You don't have to, you know, even if you live in Crestwood, you know, upper 16th Street or way across the west side of the park, you know, you don't have to drive or walk, take the bus that far to see the grit, yeah. You know, and the key is understanding it and not using it as a prop or a stereotype,
right,
or right. Something like that, to really use it as a tool, because the atmosphere is a character, especially in noir fiction. So it's basically an interplay of just historical knowledge of other people and other things, and just observation. You know, I mean, when I wrote Scavenger, which was the first book in this current trilogy, you know, I would just go out, you know, in my neighborhood and just talk to, you know, unhoused yeah. people, and people I knew were sitting there drunk or high. Now, I had my partner in crime in this was my 97-pound male German Shepherd. So he acted kind of as, you know, business agent and protector. But, you know, I don't have him anymore. I have a 7-month-old 50-pound female who's, you know, who's just too nice. But I mean, but she probably, you know, would attract people on the other end. It's like, oh, can I pet her? Can I pet?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's a combination of all those things. And, you know, as long as you're being true to the people that you're, you know, whose experiences you're using, basically, mm-hmm. and not use it as a prop,
right.
or a stereotype. I mean, that's the key. I mean, getting the information, even observing it, is one thing, and even for people who probably wouldn't have any, you know, inclination to go out and find it, you know, it's not as hard as they think.
Oh, right.
You know, that's why people say, well, I need, you know, somebody to read this for verisimilitude or to help me with cultural stuff. And I mean, most people have a semblance of common sense, no matter what their upbringing is. The problem is really the translation of it to the page.
Yeah.
To make the characters and the setting true. You know, so I mean, that's it's helpful to be a native and to see all that stuff. Yeah. And, you know, and people like Pelicanos, you know, he's a native too, and he got to see it from the point of view of the, you know, the entire ethnic kind of panoply of any urban center in America, where you see, say, the corner stores go from Jewish to Greek to Arab to Korean to Ethiopian.
Yeah.
You know, and he was in that segment where he was right in the middle of the community, even though he was white and Greek, because that was their role in the community at the time.
Yeah.
Whereas these corner store shopkeepers.
Yeah.
And he got to see a lot. And a lot of there are a lot of people, especially in my genre, one of the, you know, who won a lot of awards, like Steph Cha in L.A., is Korean and grew up in, you know, around people who owned these shops during the L.A. riots.
Yeah.
And was able to translate that on the page in terms of crime fiction, using that as a backdrop. So. Yeah. You know, these there are people who have that background, and you know, and they say, well, she went to Yale. Well, yeah, she went to Yale, but what Yale was paid for by this corner store, you know, and her family, and she was able to come back and like look at that with a critical eye. And I think that again, it's all in the use. Not the gathering is the easy part; is the use is the hard part.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you know, as you talk about the city, it's my first real exposure to D.C. was when I was still in college. I came down here for one term with a group of college students from Ohio, okay? And this was not like a Cleveland or Cincinnati or Columbus. I mean, this is a lot of college kids that are 20, 21 years old coming to the big city of Washington, D.C. But here was the funny part. They housed us in an apartment building right around the corner on Rhode Island Avenue from 14th Street. I kind of thought you might react to that because so at that point, I was just maybe 3 years older than most of these folks because I'd already been in the Army. And when we walked down 14th Street on a Friday or Saturday night, it became an extremely educational thing for a lot of these kids who had never really been out of a small town out of Ohio.
It never ceases to amaze me how many people have that story. And then their kids or their grandkids come back and they say, wait a minute, you mean the Sephora or the Shake Shack was a crack house? And there were prostitutes there? Yes.
And, you know, it was really weird because just because of the background difference, whenever they decide at 1 o'clock or 1:30 in the morning on, you know, Friday night, Saturday night, they want to go down that street for a walk, I go, well, wait a minute. Before you go walking down that street at that hour, you better make sure everybody's okay with doing something this way, because it could get to be a little interesting.
Let me tell you a little story. I mean, my nephew was watching, and he was with me, and we were just kind of channel surfing, and Jack Nicholson's movie, The Last Detail.
Oh yeah.
And he, and it tracks going from Norfolk to DC, to New York, to Boston, it's a road picture, really.
Yeah.
Even though the Navy and all that, and the scenes in D.C., it just blew his mind. You know, I mean, just how crappy and weird everything looked, and the hotel on 14th Street where they were. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, it is like that, you know, because he goes, oh wait a minute, that's the Shake Shack and the Sephora.
Yeah.
You know. And we had a similar story when we were hanging out in Brooklyn, where my parents are from, and we would go back all the time. But I was there at the Barclays Center with my nephew, and it was back when my father was alive, and he called up and he said, oh, where are you guys? And I said, well, we're at a Shake Shack. We're at the Shake Shack on Dean Street. And he goes, what do you mean the Shake Shack on Dean Street? Yeah, we're on the Shake Shack on Dean Street. He goes, well, where are the heroin addicts? I said, well, they ain't here. Yeah. This is the Shake Shack, and the Ann Taylor Loft is next door. Okay. So, you know, it's hard for people to get their brains around that. Now, the great thing for people like me, in terms of especially writing crime fiction, is I get to tell the other side of the story,
right,
which is what happened to the people who were shoved out to build the Shake Shack and the Sephora and the Ann Taylor Loft. And what do they do? Who are they? What's their story? How are they trying to hang on and maintain their dignity when there's still crime in these neighborhoods and there's still chicanery on very many levels, from the most upper level, which is the federal level, presidents and Congress, down to corrupt cops and street crime. So, you know, you've got that whole, you know, for me in D.C., I get to play with that a lot more than somebody, let's say, in Chicago or San Francisco or New York.
Well, and I think you just raise an interesting point, because the way crime is reported, shall we say, nationally at that level, as opposed to the local news guys, is very different, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you have the everyday crime that we are all aware of on the local news level. But then you also have the situation where, okay, even this year, you have some young guy who works for the Doge people early on. And because he's a victim of one crime on the street, all of a sudden, crime in D.C. becomes national news, which it wasn't when it didn't affect the people that are actually in the federal government with connections. And so you also have this dual level of reaction to the crime that occurs in the city. One is it gets so big that even the White House reacts to one, you know, one event, and then they don't care about all the other stuff that really happens. That means nothing to them. But they use that one politically and say, well, we've got to bring in the National Guard or whatever it is. But it didn't matter before, did it?
No, I mean, it this is nothing new. I mean, you know, you can look at that.
Right.
You're talking about chicanery that George H.W. Bush did, where they claim they bought crack in Lafayette Park, which was a lie. It's always a tool. It's always something to an excuse. I mean, that's not to say that you have a city government here that really is not ready for prime time, you know, consistently. That's not to say that after COVID, there was a definite spike in a lot of the crazy behavior. I mean, it was there. But, you know, to justify, it's the same kind of logic, and if you want to call it logic, that, domestic abusers use. Oh, my spaghetti's cold. Well, but it probably is cold, and it probably does taste like crap. But that doesn't mean you knock the teeth out of your wife for doing it. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's an inapt analogy.
Right.
I mean, yes, the spaghetti is cold and flavorless and looks like dog crap. But then you turn around and beat your wife because of that? Okay, it is not this. You know, I think that's an apt analogy. You know, you have a problem, and your solution is to make the problem worse, or you had no intention at all of solving the problem.
Right.
The problem just provides you with pretext to do what you want to do.
Yes,
and that is the situation here.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, I mean, let's face it, DC is like any large U.S. metropolitan city. There's always crime at some level.
Yeah. And it's usually, it's based on relationships.
Sure.
I mean, and again, that's the funny thing about, you know, any occupation that you put into place is that it's no accident. I mean, and no offense, you know, regarding these two young people, one died, one who got shot. Still in the hospital, but it's no accident that these National Guardsmen are out here picking up trash and walking around in tourist areas, twiddling their thumbs and looking for pizza, because that is what they're initially there for.
Right.
What they're the overall scheme is to be able to put them in place in case of civic unrest when people decide across the board they don't want a king. Okay, but saying, you know, oh, we're putting these people in place to fight crime. No, I mean, you know, yeah, you might stop some chain snatcher or some drunk or high idiot from grabbing somebody's purse here or there.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah. Or scare some teenagers who are kind of off, not following a curfew or something like that.
But now in your writing, well, does what's
it's
been going
really
on
not about crime?
Yeah, and how do you in your writing deal with this dual level of the federal city versus the city?
Well, it's tough. I mean, you know, it's interesting because when you're writing about, you know, some of my brother and sister writers, you know, they're talking about NYPD or the Chicago Police Department, or they'll go a bit higher if these are all police procedurals and talk about just the FBI. Here, everything is intermingled.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard for me if I bring the police in not to talk about the federal presence or the conflicts therein.
Yeah.
So, you know, but there's always, you know, when you're talking about looking at something from 100,000 feet, you know, the macro level is always going to look different than the micro level because yeah. there are people here, whether they're criminals or whether they're just trying to scrape by or they're drug dealers or they're unhoused, you know, who at a certain level don't really give a crap what's above them.
Right.
What they're talking about, what they're thinking about is right there in front of them on the curb.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter who's out there doing what. I mean, yes, there's a macro level. I mean, there's, you know, what the Congress is doing here and what the president is doing here does influence what somebody does sitting on the curb. But yeah. when they're sitting there, it's just them and the curb and whoever's in front of them and who's either a friend or foe.
Right, right.
I think a lot of people just don't get that.
And I think that it actually, you know, those two different levels really come out and hit us in the face these days, because on the one hand, you've got the rhetoric of let's get rid of illegal immigrants. And that's at the 100,000 foot level. But in the actual streets in the cities, what we have are masked law enforcement agents, although one has to question even that these days.
Yeah, because, you know, because they're not transparent about who these people are.
And so they're just dragging people away based on the way somebody looks, the way somebody speaks, nothing more. And so, you know, there's the political rhetoric, but as you say, out actually on the street, what's actually going on is completely different.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, it could be something relatively benign, like, you know, we have tariffs, you know, something you would know about, tariffs in a trade war, whatever, with China or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the average person, you know, going into a corner store or some botanica or bodega in these neighborhoods, you know, they don't really give, they don't care where something's made. Yeah. They might on a certain level, you know, but they want the cheapest thing. And the cheapest thing isn't necessarily the best for you. It could blow up in your face.
Yeah.
It could poison you.
Yeah.
But they're looking for something, you know, they're in survival mode.
Yeah,
you know, and so if you were to talk, yeah, and you talk saying, look, it was made in China, and it was made with child labor. Well, some of them might say, well, I want my child to have some labor. You know, you know, it might not make any sense, and a lot of times it doesn't.
No,
but you know, you're dealing with that. You know, and here of all places, you're dealing with this up and down and horizontal axis too, these spectrums that yeah. you don't have in these other cities.
Right.
And, you know, you have to pay attention to that stuff.
Yeah. I'm always amazed about when you talk about the international stuff. For me, what's always hilarious is, yes, we want all this stuff to come back and be made here and so on and so forth. And my immediate question is, and are we willing to pay the higher price? Because the general public wants, as you say, things cheaper. And so are they really willing? Are they open to the idea that, oh, if you want all those jobs back here and pay the prices based upon the labor rates in the United States versus somewhere else, and all the benefits these workers get here, which they don't get somewhere else, which is also factored into the price, are we actually willing to pay the price that you're going to pay, you know, not so much at a Target or a Walmart, but Bloomingdale's. Are you willing to do that every day for everything? That's the question.
Yeah, it's and you know, and again, on a micro level, you know, you have people who might turn around and say, well, you know, people wouldn't have to sell drugs or be on drugs as an escape or as an anesthetic if they had these menial, dangerous jobs that you do overseas. You know, I mean, which makes no sense. I mean, and, you know, at one time in our history, on some level, it did make sense. Yes, you needed people off the boat, quite literally, to go down in the East River and dig those caissons for the Brooklyn Bridge and to dig all those sewers and tunnels for $5 a day for even that. But, you know, but that was back in an expanding economy where other people, you know, could maybe make good on that salary because the loaf of bread was 10 cents or less, and they could maybe move up. And then later generations, you had unions that could help with that. Well, a lot of these people now, that's not the case. I mean, you can't sit there and go, well, if we did away with all environmental regulations, all these people who are selling drugs and on SNAP, they could make money being ships,
yeah,
you know, on the beach or banks or Ocean City, you know, and do it in flip-flops like they do in India. I mean, it's not the same thing, but they try to conflate the two, and it's really, it's really aggravating, you know. But again, I think a lot of these people who are conflating it from the top are doing it because they know a lot of the people who are doing it towards the bottom are stupid and will believe anything they say because they want to believe this stuff. Oh,
yeah.
Well, if four people could break ships in flip-flops on some mythical beach where they're not going to let them do it, but on some mythical beach, we wouldn't need SNAP. Wouldn't need Obamacare. You know, it's moronic to the point of insulting any normal person's intelligence.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to switch gears on you here for a moment because your latest book, the title is Streetwise, right?
If I'm yes, correct. I happen to have one right here.
So here's the question about the title. Why is it WYWHYS and not WISE?
A number of things. The most craven is it sounds cool. I mean, you're competing with all these other people, especially in the trade paperback industry, especially in our genre. I mean, you know, we're all buddies, we're all friends, but we're also competitors.
Of course.
So, I mean, yes. You know, the craziest title you could come up with. I mean, you look at the what they call the domestic suspense subgenre in our genre. I mean, it's no accident that they have titles like Gone Girl or Girl on the Train, because you're talking about mostly, 25 to 30 year old. I'm sorry, my dog is attacking me. 25 to 30 year old to 50 year old women watching, you know, and or reading, and they are you want to have girl in the title. I mean, it's something stupid, like, you know, but as effective as that. But also it meets the plot, so it's got to grab people, but also has to meet the plot, like what's going on. Streetwise, and it's one word, you know, it is kind of it isn't really two words. I mean, I'm working on one now. The tentative title is Bad Samaritan. So now, again, I mean, there has to be something subtle in there. I mean, you know, the subtlety is, and I'm not a Bible scholar, but, you know, the reason why he was a good Samaritan is because at that time, the people in the Levites and the Jews hated Samaritans. So he was a good Samaritan because he helped. Yeah. But that was part of the parable. It's like, you shouldn't use that term good or bad. It's that, you know, he was, you know, the reason he helped was he was the exemplar of what we should all be like. So there has to be that deeper, something that grabs you on just an oomph kind of level, you know, kind of a reptilian brain level, and something that makes you think on a human ape brain level. And so, you know, streetwise, you know, so, you know, and you dig deeper, or Bad Samaritan. Well, was it, shouldn't it, is a good Samaritan? Well, no, it's not. It's just a Samaritan, but everybody hated Samaritans back then. So he was good because he helped somebody.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an ape and reptile thing. I'll just point, you know, any biologists out there, well, you know, they'll understand that.
So do you usually come up with the titles on your own, or do you have some help with, you know, whether it's an editor, publisher, whomever?
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, I came up with it on my own. With this latest trilogy, it was really the publisher. Hmm. He's the title guru. Uh-huh. You know, he's the title whisperer. You know, that's his superpower. Yeah. So, because I thought he had meant streetwise with WISE, and he's like, no, you know, WHYS, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, well, I know when I noticed that, I thought, well, this is an interesting way to do it. The sound is one thing, and then to see it in print is completely different. So I thought, well, there must be a little bit of a backstory on how or why that was chosen.
Yeah. It's purely, again, it's initial oomph reptile brain, and then you start to roll it over. Does it meet the themes and the plot? What other secondary meanings does it have?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. No, it's, I think, again, it's one of those things that we write, but we don't. And then as we're writing, maybe the title comes up midway or at the end.
That happens.
Yeah.
There are people who think up a title and then write to the title, and there are people who don't know up until the bitter end.
Yeah. And then I think sometimes it's just a matter of, well, now that I've got the story written, what actually, quote, fits, shall we say?
And in the publishing industry, that becomes, you know, something to talk about. You know, I mean, that becomes a, you know, you might have a fight over titles and cover art and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, the title sometimes becomes the second fight or the second front of the fight.
Well, I know that
I was just lucky enough to have somebody who thought that stuff up right off the bat, you know.
I think it was after the first novel that we were sitting, and I was looking around, and I didn't have a title really. And all of a sudden I realized that when I was reading back through it all, I had the action going back and forth between Washington, D.C. and Tokyo. And all of a sudden I thought of the idea of a pendulum swinging back and forth, because the action goes back and forth between the two locations. And it was a matter of finding a way to have the word pendulum in the title.
Just
to give it that, you know, that imagery.
Sometimes it's as easy or as hard as that. You know, it's there's no magic to it, really. But I mean, the issue, let me put it this way, there's no magic to it, but you have to find some kind of formula.
Yeah.
Because thought has to go into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just can't throw that away. Right. I mean, I think people who do a lot of, you know, if you do legal writing or you write, do a lot of nonfiction, and then you try to do fiction, I think that there's a hard, there are hard lessons there. It's a hard transition.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, somebody asked, well, what's easier? And I said, well, nonfiction for me is a lot easier. I mean, you know what your topic is, you know what research you have to do, and then you just put it together. And, fiction, I mean, it's, at least for those of us who've written, you know, as lawyers, we know that, you know, you read a lot of cases, you have to put the cases together and blah, blah. I mean, it's all that. But fiction is, well, wait a minute, I've got to come up with the characters, their backstory. I've got to come up with the scenes and where it's going to be, you know, where's the location? I mean, you got to put it all together. Nonfiction is just, it's basically research.
It is. It's research. I mean, there's a certain art to it. And if you can, you can find that art, then you're a bestseller, you know, there, or if you have like a cult of personality around you. But it you know, I think it is a lot. There's a lot to say, evidence to show that it's easier if you want to use, and you know, that people are listening in, I'm using air quotes here, you know, the video portion, it is easier. And some people will say that. I mean, I had the great fortune of going to college with Michael Lewis, and you know, and he's written all kinds of books, you know, everything from, you know, from The Blind Side to Liar's Poker to everything. And he has said, you know, Chris, I don't know how you guys do this, because it is tough. And I'm, you know, and for him to say that, that's like, oh wow, okay. Yeah. Wish I had your numbers. Yeah. You know. But you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. No. Well, I don't know how much longer we'll go, but I really appreciate you giving us your time today. And I would just say to anybody listening, that you should take a look at Chris's writings, Christopher Chambers, and his various books and his many awards for his writing. And really enjoyed the conversation today, and appreciate the time.
Thank you.
And I don't know if there's any last words or thoughts of wisdom you want to share.
I think people need to keep reading, and I know that sounds trite and kind of dumb, but you know, I mean, my genre is one of the main legs of American literature: mystery, crime fiction, thrillers. I mean, we've been around since Poe, but even we are taking it on the chin because people just aren't, you know, reading as much, and I think that, you know, your world expands, and you know, a lot of people don't want their world to expand. A lot of people are out there in this city, as a matter, and you know this, as a matter of policy, they want the people's worlds and brains to shrink.
Yeah,
and that's crazy.
No,
or move off to another genre that's utterly nuts. You know, like, you know, cosplay fantasy romance or something like that. Yeah. I mean, you know. You want to engage your creativity, but you also want to engage your brain. And you know, you keep the benefits of all of that are amazing. And you know, we have, it's a part of the culture. We have to just keep going.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm hoping that people understand that. Yeah. And it's reading one thing is a bridge to another.
Yeah.
Reading my stuff is a bridge, or even starting off a kid with a graphic novel. There are graphic novels and comic books that are amazingly well written, probably more well written, and of course well drawn than most novels.
Yeah,
and yeah. You know, and there are bridges to other things, and then there are bridges to nonfiction.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, for kids, I mean, think about the comic book as kid, hopefully leading to wanting to read something more and you know, longer.
Yeah.
But when you're a kid and you have comic books, I mean, you go from that and graduate to something else. And, you know, what you said just a moment ago is also true, that, you know, from my perspective, I mean, the few novels that I have, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really trying to get people, if they read it, you know, hopefully what they realize is something that can happen 6,000 miles away actually does have an impact on you here.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just because it's way over there that it means nothing. You have to be aware of what happens way over there, because it does have an impact over here. And there's that connection, that relationship, both personal as well as geographical.
So. Yeah. And again, as we're both saying, it's a bridge, because they'll go from your novel to nonfiction, which will fill in the gaps and you know, with the facts and figures and the history. And you know, we can't be a functioning society, you know, without this. And you know, we're starting to show the wear and tear of that now.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a great way to hopefully encourage people to keep reading. And who knows, maybe pick up one of your books, one of my books. We'll see.
Yep.
Absolutely. Hey, well, everything helps.
Yes.
It All does. Right. Everything helps. You know, my son graduated from Harvard. I love to say that out loud in May. And the commencement was, the speech was read. That was the message to all these brilliant students, you know, read fiction. So pick up Tim's books, timothytrainer.com, where you'll find The China Connection and The China Factor and so many more. And also chrischambersnoir.com, where you'll find all of Chris's books, including some that he's written. Streetwise is his latest. Some that he's written for The Avengers. So it's really exciting to meet you both. I had the privilege of meeting you at Elaine's Literary Salon, where I am the PR director as well. So now I get to be the publicist for both of you brilliant authors and just sharing that message that Chris just said, you know, read, read, read. It makes you smarter. It makes you wiser. It opens your heart. And I love just being in the vicinity of like-minded folks. So here's to 2026. Thank you both for today. Yes. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of Tim's Travails on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV, and also Chris Chambers Noir, which is another show that we produce. So thank you both. Stay well, happy holidays, and we'll see you next year.